This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The sex is in the heel, even if you break it. This week, the Broadway musical Kinky Boots swept the nominations for the Tony Awards with 13. Among them, for Best Direction by Jerry Mitchell, Best Book by Harvey Fierstein, and Best Score by Cyndi Lauper. The New York Times noted that if she wins, she'll become the first woman ever to win solo in the category. The musical's based on the 2005 British movie about a real-life struggling shoe factory that finds new life in producing quality boots for transvestites, which makes perfect sense as a subject for Lauper, not just because of her advocacy of LGBT issues, but because it hits yet again the guiding theme of her life, as recounted in her new memoir and her work since her emergence as a pop artist in the 80s. Be whoever you choose to be, a simple message tough to carry out, which she knows all too well. Recently, I had a long conversation with Cyndi Lauper before a live audience in the green space here at WNYC, and we started by playing the video of the song that introduced her to the world. The phone rings in the middle of the night, my boy. Yes, I know.
Show, are they watching it too?
The people listening to the webcast are watching it and can watch it in perpetuity. But you didn't really want to sing that song, did you?
Not in the beginning. Because, you know, it was written by a guy. And, of course, a guy's not going to sing about what I'd want to sing about. There's a guy. Could you imagine? So, you know, when he said, you know, Father dear, we are the fortunate ones, you know, my little rebel heart took issue with it.
We have a little snippet of Robert Hazard's Bowie-esque original.
Know, there is something cool about this that nobody else ever heard. Rick Chertoff collected these songs and was looking for a singer. He didn't know he was going to get me. You know, it's like a dress. You go to the department store, you try on a dress. Let me tell you, not every dress fits good on you. Same with a song. You put a song on, you have to know the story that you are telling. You have to come from a place where you own the story because you know it. And when you connect to it and you tell the truth, you will resonate the truth to a listener. And when it came to girls, I couldn't get girls to sit right. Rick said to me, listen, he said, think of what it could mean if you sang it. And I thought about it.
You wrote that you had the faces of a lot of sad women in your head when you were reconstructing that song. And it's not by accident that your mom was in the video. She was caught in the kind of trap that you didn't want to be in.
It wasn't just me. If you look at all the women of that time, or even women now who still struggle all over the world, you don't always get the fair shake that everybody thinks you get. In fact, you get a half a handshake, basically. And I just felt like when he said, think of what it could mean, I saw my grandmother, I saw my aunt, and I saw my mother. These were women that were disenfranchised. You got to understand, my family came from Sicily. In Sicily, they don't look at women like an opportunity for a life. They look at women as two opportunities. You marry a morph to somebody wealthy, or they stay home as free domestic help. You know, they don't go out and get educated. They weren't allowed to write, you know, stories. So I did it. And when I did it, I made sure I got as many multiracial girls as I could in the lineup so that no matter where it played in the world or the country, any little girl of any color could look at themselves and see themselves and know that they too should have a joyful existence and are, you know, entitled. And we did it under the guise of fun while we were all laughing, and I was the big idiot. The big thing was everybody, every woman is entitled, not just some. So I felt proud that we were able to get by the gatekeepers, you know.
You left Ozone Park at 17. You
yes.
stuffed a change of underwear, an apple, and a book in a paper bag.
Yes, and a book called Grapefruit.
So by Yoko Ono.
Yes, it changed my life. The Beatles, Joni Mitchell, the Rolling Stones, the Sly and the Family Stone, all those wonderful songs that helped me exist. And my mother's beautiful books, you know, she always had the Rubaiyats of Omar Khayyam. You know, she took us to see Shakespeare at the Delacorte Theater. She never took us to see Broadway. She thought it was too expensive. But I learned all her records because that's what I sang. At 4 years old, I played The King and I every day. So much so that and I knew every word and every breath and every character. My grandmother came from upstairs. She walked downstairs, opened the door, took the record off of the little red record player, went back upstairs with it without saying a word. And then when Funny Girl happened, she gave up.
I know that you were hitchhiking around. You had to train yourself how not to be hungry. You had some bad experiences.
Yeah, but I did not want to have success on somebody else's terms. Everything I wanted to do, I wanted to own it. I wanted it to be mine.
You wrote in your book that from the very start, you were hell-bent on mixing art and music, the visual and the sound and the story. I wanted to be larger than life, to look completely different. I wanted to be a painting.
I am still a painting. They painted me for hours.
Do you feel a kinship at all with Lady Gaga?
Well, I think that she grew up watching me and Madonna and Annie Lennox and Boy George, and I think all of it influenced her, and also she was an art major.
Madonna emerged just a little bit after you, and her record company and the media tried to cook up some kind of rivalry.
Well, you know, it's always that way with women. They always have to pit one against the other. You know, not very imaginative, is it? And I didn't like to be pit against another woman. I couldn't do that. And I just felt kind of lost because I thought they appreciated my art. And all of a sudden, it was this contest. And I just felt like, you know, I want to make great music. And I want to kick some butt. And she was a wonderful businesswoman who never, I don't know that she really got into fights with anyone. She was much smarter, where I lost my allies and I said like all the wrong things to the right people. And I never explained how I felt. I would find myself in situations and be like, yeah, well, you know, F you. I can't say that, can I? It's public radio.
We can bleep it.
Well, I just said F.
Oh, that you can totally say.
All right, so...
But we'll bleep it anyway, just so it sounds more authentic.
Well, you know, like the first record company I went to, I mean, that's why it probably took so long. I was signed by this German company. They said to me, we're going to make you into the next Streisand. And I looked at them, I said, what do you want to do that for? I said, what kind of lobotomy do I need? I said, listen, why don't you find somebody else and do that? And I think everybody at the table choked because he happened to be the president. But you know what? If you can't be honest, why do you want to live a life where, and why would you suffer so long to finally get to a place where you couldn't tell the truth and be yourself? In the arts and in music, you know, everybody says, well, what happened to music? Yeah, what happened to music? It became full of shit. It became not truthful. In the 80s, all those crazy outfits and hairdos, yeah, they were rough and wild and weird. But it originated with the people who were singing and performing. It originated with the performers. And there's some idiot come in and say, well, I don't think you should do that. You know, somebody told me, they said, oh, I think your makeup, it shouldn't be like that. And I'm thinking to myself, that's right, biatch, soon as you're out of here. And then it just, from then on, it became war paint. That's what turned me around. You know, 1989, they used to say to me, well, what the hell is that you're wearing? Why can't you wear jeans and a T-shirt like Katrina and the Waves? I'd be like, oh, my God.
You weren't walking on sunshine?
I wanted to take some sunshine. You know, the problem was that they also threatened you because George Michaels, when he tried to get out of the contract, they sued him and said they were going to tie up his career and look how his career is ruined. You will be ruined. They always threatened me with ruination. And after a while, when I was ruined, I figured, hey, I could do whatever the hell I want now because, you know, once you're on the bottom, what are they going to do? Put another nail in the coffin? Obviously, it didn't work, did it? Because I keep coming back, so what the hell?
What always struck me about your singing, the whole honest thing that you do, is its fearlessness and its generosity. And I found this 1985 clip of you with Patti LaBelle.
Flashback, warm nights, almost left behind. Suitcase of memories. Time out.
Oh, sometimes you picture me. I'm falling to our head. You're calling to me. And hear a word you said that you said.
I wish I could play the whole thing. It's pretty.
Truthfully, when I heard her sing Time After Time, I cried. Inside, I felt like, well, it's one of the greatest voices ever, and she's singing one of my songs. And I was always told, you know, I had to fight so hard to get my own songs on my own record because I was told that I wasn't a good enough writer. And I was always told most of my life that a woman with a big voice sings, not writes. And then Mariah Carey came along, and she gave one four. Good for her.
After that, obviously it was smooth sailing, except for the bankruptcy and losing your voice. And
my path was never like anybody else's, even after I freaking became famous, when I thought, okay, now it's Easy Street. The Easy Street I have not found, except for when Harvey Fierstein called me up, and I just finished a Punishment tour, which I thought, oh, do Rough Riding, go to Europe, doesn't matter, get on a smelly, stinky bus, you know, sweat, be grungy. I don't like dirt. So when Harvey called me and he said, do you want to write for me? This was Harvey Fierstein, who is a great storyteller. I admire him so much. And he called me and asked me if I wanted to write for him. Of course I said yes. It's been an unbelievable experience for me. And I chased over the whole world. And I felt like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, you know, the lion, the tin man, and the scarecrow. I had all three of them walking me through, Steve Arimus, Jerry Mitchell, and Harvey Fierstein, you know who's who. And I realized at the end, after I chased the whole world, what I should have just looked at was my own backyard, because Broadway is a very comfortable place for me.
Kinky Boots. It's based on the British film about an old school shoe company passed down three generations. It's going under. The son can either fire the employees he grew up with or reinvent the company. What they have to do is find a niche market.
And he happens to bump into Lola, a drag queen, being attacked. And she had pulled off her shoe and said, I can handle the likes of these guys, and knocks them out with her shoe. And then he told her later on, oh, I could fix this, cheaply made. She's, no, expensive shoes, cheaply made, Lola said. So he went back, and he was still struggling, and all of a sudden he realized the niche market was sitting right in front of him on the chair. He could make a kinky boot, you know, or a boot. He didn't know how kinky yet. You know, it's a development thing
for
him. Yeah,
that goes on. Now let's play Step the Revelations. One. Step one.
Are they going to see this?
Yes.
On the radio?
No.
It's time for a shake-up. Look at me, wake up. Taking control. This is a new beginning. My gears are spinning. Let's rock and roll. Just put one foot onward and forward. I used to be a zero, but now I clearly feel that I may be the hero who reinvents the heel. I may be facing the impossible. I may be chasing after miracles. And there may be the steepest mountain to overcome. But this is step one. Yeah, this is step one.
A member of the audience asked, what were her sources of inspiration over the years?
Doesn't matter. You know, it comes from someplace. Excellent. Who cares? You know, just be open to anything. Because when you're creating, it feels bigger than yourself. And it's better to be involved with things that are bigger than yourself sometimes. And also you have to always, always remember, and me too, I'm like a bully. I have to remember kindness and generosity. And with that, things come. Knit, for goodness sakes, if it makes you feel good. Do creative things. It feeds the other side of your brain. You know, do any kind of music. Play a freaking instrument. It's joyful. It's joyful. It makes you feel better. I play a dulcimer because them open fifths when you strum it, it's so soothing. You know, it's just soothing. And, you know, that's scientific because there's a doctor that worked in maybe Creedmoor. No, not Creedmoor. Bellevue. And he worked with tuning forks. I got them tuning forks, and they have the open fifths, very soothing. So I thought, oh, it's scientific.
Perfect. My conversation with Cyndi Lauper lasted more than an hour. What you just heard is a heavily edited construction based on a wide-ranging journey through her mind and heart, with stops in the recording studio, various churches, grunge fashion, the music industry, reality TV, her mother's womb, the White House, and much, much more. Plus video. To take it all in, go to AlmaMedia.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Murray, Krista Ripple, and Doug Anderson. We had more help from Alexandra Hall and Rebecca Koenig. And it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.